Hi there, welcome to The Manuscript. I'm Breno Barreto.
And I'm Juliana Meyer.
And in this podcast, we delve into the intersection of writing and the development of technology products. Every couple of weeks, we talk to people making a difference in technical writing, art and design, UX writing, content strategy, and anywhere else there's someone thinking about content and digital products and the tech industry. If you want to keep up with our latest news and insights, pitch in on things for us to talk about, and also get some behind the scenes, follow us on Twitter. The link is in our show notes. And don't forget to subscribe to The Manuscript wherever you get your podcasts so you know whenever we publish a fresh new episode.
All right, so quick announcements before we jump right into today's conversation. So this episode is especially interesting for you, fellow tech writer or aspiring tech writer out there in the world, who wants to know more about this market and what it really feels like to join the tech industry as a tech writer. Or if you're already working with tech writing and you'd like to know what some top-notch companies are doing with their documentation. We interviewed John A. Paz, and we'll get into his story in a moment. But our chat with John was so inspiring to us that we just had to share the full conversation with you. And to improve your podcasting experience, we split it into two episodes. So today, you'll listen to part one, where we explore John's career, his experience in tech writing at Atlassian and Menlo, illustrated with his real day-to-day challenges, and how tech writing can be a great entry point for people interested in joining the tech market. So stay tuned to listen to part two to get the full picture. Oh, and also, quick heads up. We're still recording from our homes in the pandemic, which sometimes causes a poorer audio quality than what we're used to. But please bear with us, since the content of today's episode is totally worth it.
So today we're very excited because we'll be interviewing John Paz, who is a content designer at Menlo Security. First of all, thanks a lot, John, for joining us. It's really an honor and a pleasure. So can you start off by getting a little introduction of yourself and share with our listeners a little bit about your path?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you all so much for having me here. I'm blown away by the offer and the opportunity. And your show is so altruistic. Your goals and what you guys talk about, I think it's going to really make a difference in encouraging people to understand this entryway into technology, which is through writing. So I'll just jump right into kind of my origin story. I always knew I was going to be a writer when I was growing up, especially in high school. My mother is an English professor, and she always encouraged her and my father always encouraged lots of reading, lots of writing, exploration. Because my mother's a professor, I'd have really interesting, smart people over the house for barbecues all the time, and they always talked to us like we were adults, the children. From a very early age, I've always been taught to kind of challenge status quo and argue your points and make your case. By the time I was in university, I had to pick a career, and I knew it was going to be writing. And my wife and I were having kids very early in life, and so technical writing seemed like the best way to get my family to a stable income and to also use my talent in communication to kind of make money. Before that, if you had asked me, I probably was planning on half finishing a novel for a decade, and just being a human man and just living life. But life had other plans for me, so I had to grow up real quick. And it was the best decision I ever made was going into tech writing. And for anybody who will listen, I tell you, you don't have to like tech. You don't have to like tech. You don't have to like computers or computer science. But if you can tolerate it, or if you're good at it, there's enough money to be made there where you won't have to do that for the rest of your life. And so the rest is history in terms of that. But I love talking about my origin stories with my former employer, Atlassian, because that's the thing that most people like to talk about, because Jira, Confluence, Trello, the whole gamut, the whole team, they're a lot of fun to talk about. They're really trendy enterprise software. And I spent almost 6 years at Atlassian. So I don't work there anymore. I still very much consider myself a fan of their products and a fan of their company. And I've got a lot of friends that work there that I care very much about. But it was 2015 when Atlassian made me an offer to move me and my wife and our three kids from Orlando, Florida to Sydney, Australia, which is unheard of, especially if someone on an English degree. I still kick myself and I'm figuring out how the heck did that happen. All of a sudden, I find myself in an airport in Sydney at 9 a.m. when it's by my watch, it's actually the day before. And it was hot in the middle of January. It was like 40 something degrees in the middle of January. And it was cold when I left Orlando. So it was very surreal. But I spent not quite 3 years in Sydney working on Bitbucket Server. Atlassian had some other roles that seemed to be a little more aligned with what I wanted to do. So I moved and jumped ship and moved the whole family across the world for a second time to San Francisco. And that was an adventure of a lifetime for sure. Not just the actual move itself, which, as you can imagine, so many moving pieces with so many human beings and moving house twice across the world. But the moving to California was just, I'd never been to California, even though I'd lived in Australia, I'd been to South America, Europe. It was my first time in California when I moved there. I visited once before, but it was like a dream. California is amazing. It's everything the movies say it is and more. And lots of things that you don't even see in the brochure. It's a paradise, but it's also like the most expensive place to live in the world. And even with the very generous salary that I was getting, it was still just not able to kind of accumulate the kind of upward trajectory in my personal finances that I'd hoped from all the money that I seemed to be making on paper. I put in requests many times before, but finally towards my last year at Atlassian, they allowed me to go remote and move back to Florida. So I came full circle back to Orlando, where my wife and I met and where our kids were born, where both our parents are, my mom and dad and her mom live here. So after five and a half years, the circle of life, we ended up back here, but during a pandemic. So it's like,
oh my God.
No parade, there's no coming home parties. And it's, it was a bittersweet, some well-needed relief into my budget. Cost of living in Orlando is significantly lower than California. It was a long time coming into that whole journey. And it's a fun thing to talk about. And I like to use it to kind of inspire people to think big who may not have ever seen themselves in tech before. And I say, you can look at me as evidence that you can do it. I think that I had a pretty unique advantage in a good family and being American. I don't think anybody is that far away from it. If the internet and computers in general is a great equalizer. So technology can and is changing the world. And I think that if you can do it through writing, I say go for it. It's not a bad way to make a living.
Wow, amazing. We're not even 10 minutes into this episode and I'm already getting emotional and touched from my end. So really, thank you so much for sharing your path and being so vulnerable about how you felt throughout the process. We really appreciate it. And I'm really glad that we're doing this episode. Let me just warn our listeners that there might be some fangirl rant from now on. But going back to our questions. So in your portfolio, you say that you're not the typical techie since you didn't take a traditional path to working in tech. How do you think your education influenced the way you built your career?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, because I take a lot of pride in not being a traditional techie. I think that's actually like my superpower. It's what gives me an edge in helping to design solutions on both in prior employers and at my current employer. And so, like I mentioned, I do have an English degree with a focus in technical writing, but it's legitimately an arts and humanities degree. I have a degree from the same department that my mother, who is a professor, she works in. She's a literature professor. And so I've always had a great respect for the arts, and I'm an avid reader, especially of fiction and historical fiction, science fiction, fantasy, big time. So I am a dreamer. I'm a creator. So when I first started in technical writing, I got really nervous that this was going to be a job that I was not going to be able to be successful in, if only because I need to have some joy from my work. Otherwise, it's really hard to get up every day. But the best jobs that I've ever worked, and I think the first 8 years, maybe the first 9 years of my career, I had a different job every year because I was a contractor. And it didn't bother me much because a lot of those jobs were not fun. or worked for employers who just weren't building things that I could get behind. It was difficult to put my whole self into things, products that I didn't really believe in. So when I finally landed in software, it was a no-brainer because I got to explore the depths of my creativity. Because if you know, be the change you seek is very much a mantra in almost all tech companies. If you find a problem and you got the time and the energy to solve it, go forth and solve that problem. Whereas in prior employers and more traditional kind of engineering shops and DoD employers, I got my hand smacked all the time for innovating. And I didn't understand it until probably my third or fourth job.
That's so sad.
I worked myself out of a contract at one point where I finished early and there was no more work left for me to do. And then they said thanks and shut me the door when it was over.
That's so, a way to crush talent.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I, they did me a favor because if I had stayed there longer, they were chronically underpaying me. Their benefits were more expensive than they were worth. And it was like an hour and a half drive for me to get there. So they did me a favor. I bring a novice mindset intentionally. And before it was because I was a novice and didn't work in software before. So now I bring these fresh glasses to every meeting and ask the silly questions. At this stage of my career, I'm confident enough that I know that there's no such thing as a dumb question. But those questions that challenge basic foundational assumptions, they tend to be the ones that bear the most fruit. And it's hard to challenge those things when everyone thinks they know what the other is thinking. Those homogeneous groups, it's rife in there, that kind of confirmation bias.
Yeah, totally agree. And it's amazing to have professionals like this inside a company. So, John, in your LinkedIn profile, you describe yourself as a content-centric design professional, which is an interesting description and not that usual one. So how much of a designer mindset do you think that good content professionals have when they're working with technical products?
Ooh, you took that question in a different direction than I thought. I don't think it's necessary, but I think you make yourself much more valuable the more kind of design or visual aesthetic eye that you have and are willing to contribute towards design. I think it's just like coding, right? Like with technical writing, if there's a spectrum, and with content design, any kind of word-related tech field, I think there's a spectrum of technicality and of kind of design ability. And it's totally possible to have both. I like to think that I have some good technical chops and some good design aesthetic chops. But more often than not, someone will have really strong on one or the other. And that's perfectly fine. There's enough pie out here we can all eat, because the really technical writers they're going to be getting paid the most because they're in the highest demand, and it's probably the hardest to learn just from a starting standpoint. The API writers, developer documentation writers, but UX writers are not getting paid that much less, and there's almost just as many companies now kind of seeing the gospel of the value of UX writing. So to answer your question, I think it's absolutely invaluable unless you've got something else that kind of sets you apart. And I don't mean set you apart to mean like you're a superstar, or instead of being set apart, it's not necessarily about performance. It's just about what your interests are. You're going to get more job satisfaction from a job that gives you that extra 20% time to do something that you find interesting or valuable, rather than having to learn algorithms and coding. Like, oh, I hate JavaScript. Well, then you probably don't want to go be an API writer for the documented JavaScript API. So so it's invaluable to have a niche, but I don't think it's necessary because it'll start to work itself out earlier in your career just by who you're getting jobs to.
I really appreciate how we're exploring the tech writing market in this episode, and to dive a bit deeper into that field. So tech writing isn't exactly a new profession. If you think about it, Leonardo da Vinci was a tech writer himself. Like, mm-hmm. He created products and then wrote documentation about it to explain how it worked. But there seems to be a rising market momentum right now for writers inside technology. Do you agree? And what do you think is driving this movement?
Oh, I 100% agree. And I'll digress just briefly. You hit the nail on the head. Tech writing is one of the oldest professions, if only because religious texts are actually, back in the day, they used to function essentially like technical documents telling you what you can and cannot do. I have a whole blog post that I pitched to a magazine about what I called epic tech docs in history, talking about the most influential documents in human history.
I can't believe I haven't read this. It seems so interesting.
You didn't read it because it got shelved because it was too controversial, because I opened up with the Bible as the best example of this. And there,
that's bold.
I know. And I'm actually I'm a Catholic, and I go to church off sometimes, and I didn't think it was that controversial, but the reaction I got from some people in the editor's room, I was like, you know what? I'm not ready for that kind of backlash. And I don't feel so strongly about it. It's just a neat idea. But digression gone now. Oh man. That's the thing that, when I go talk to people who are English writing students or writing professionals looking for the next gig, I say tech is your holy grail. It is the answer to everything you want. And it may not be the thing that you like, but it's going to feed you, and it's going to be plentiful. And to be honest with you, in the grand scheme of things, the kind of work that tech needs the most is the stuff that writers do the easiest. The innovative ideas, sometimes they come from engineers, sometimes they come from designers, but just the same way, writers can always pitch in and talk about why do we call it this? Is there a reason for this naming convention? And naming conventions, nomenclature is easy pickings for exponentially increasing your value at work. If you just say, can I be invited to a project kickoff meeting? And that's an appropriate time to challenge those kinds of things. Challenging a naming convention when something's already gone to quality assurance, is you're going to make a lot of enemies that way, and it's not going to be fun. But you get in early and often, and all of a sudden people are like, oh man, this writer person knows what they're talking about. And it's try not to be offended, because people don't always connect the dots that writers are good with words, which means they're good with naming things as well. And so it's very slowly, the high tech companies of the world, the giants, the Googles, the Facebooks and Apples, they're hiring small armies of UX writers alongside their technical writers, and asking them to exclusively focus on UI copy. That's how important it is. And they're making good money too. These are well-paid positions, and with very reputable companies with incredible perks and benefits. This is a great way to make money. And it's when I show people what UI copy is and how you interact with it every day and how easy it is to get right, but how bad it can be when it's wrong, it's the value of a content professional is very apparent. It's you don't even have to make it into dollars and cents. It's just that when the words in an application, when they don't get in your way and they help the experience, you can have an intuitive app all you want to. People are going to look for the words. So the value of the written word is only going to increase from here on out, because we're like an asynchronous world now. It's the new reality.
Yes, some heroes don't wear capes.
Yeah, indeed.
All right. In your presentation about tech writing tools, you mentioned several different core and specialized tools for tech writing. And you also mentioned video editing tools. When and where do you think video should be used in documentation? This is a discussion that we've had previously in our show and in the teams that we work on, Brenda and myself, as tech writers. Is it always desirable to add videos? What are some of the challenges for this media type?
This is one of those truth bomb questions where if you want to get a bunch of tech writers in a room and have them argue, ask this question, because there's enough opinions on it where it's all about what you're trying to achieve. And I think it all about it, in the same breath, it depends on what kind of resources you have. If you're good at making videos and you're also a technical writer and you don't have a lot of other resources, it may be that using short videos and embedded in the documentation get your users towards closer to their goal than having a bunch of small articles. It's a cop out of an answer to say it depends, but I think it really does depend on the resources you have available and what you're trying to accomplish. My rule of thumb usually is if I can get it done with 150 words, there's no point in needing a video. But if I can get the video done in 30 seconds and it'd be 10 pages or more, then the video might be worth it. But the hardest part about videos is that they have tricky maintenance costs, and that when the UI changes, you have to go through and update the entire video or just include disclaimers that this might not be right and that feels yucky. So I say there's pros and cons to each. I always want people to justify the need for a video. Like if there's a target audience who specifically prefers to have videos and is shown not to be clicking on documentation links, by all means, go to where the users are. But just having videos for the sake of videos has got a bunch of sneaky costs that will really, they'll annoy you way later down the road. And when they do, you'll wish you hadn't done them.
Cool. So, John, I'd like us to talk a little about your recent and current job experiences. So you've recently joined Menlo Security, right? After working as a content designer at Atlassian. So can you share with us how that transition went and what you've learned in this process?
Sure. It was a very emotional time for me. Obviously, as I've said throughout this interview, that I very much love Atlassian and I love Atlassians and I love Atlassian's products. And I wasn't even passively really looking for work when I was approached by one of the VPs of product at Menlo. And he text messaged me, and I still don't know how he got my phone number, but I won't digress on that. He text messaged me and said, I work for a security startup. I've been kind of cyber stalking you for a little while, all your diversity work, people of color and tech article. And this was the day after I gave the keynote at Button. And I actually assumed that he kind of saw my presentation at Button and he hadn't even heard of Button. But he said, I've been following you around and I think that you're the kind of person that we need to kind of establish our documentation department. And so I was very wary because, like I said, I actually just switched roles for the third time in Atlassian. And I was on a team full of engineers, the only writer, but a team that I love very much with people who I thought the world of, who respected me and valued my contribution and wanted to get me, wanted to unblock me from doing the best work of my life. And so it was, I tried to scare these people. I tried to scare Menlo off with, saying, hey, I got lofty salary expectations and Atlassian was my dream job. I moved across the world twice for Atlassian. Y'all are going to really have to come with it. And they did not blink. And what was actually the most appealing part of this, I had an opportunity to break into management, which I'm about 15 years now as a technical writer, as an individual contributor level. Y'all know what I mean. Yeah. So I was ready for the next step. And at Atlassian, when I moved to San Francisco, there just was not as many technical writers to manage in the San Francisco U.S. side of things. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to have the patience to wait for another opportunity to materialize. With a heavy heart and leaving some friends who helped me through some real challenging times, I made the leap to a cybersecurity startup. And I didn't know the first thing about cybersecurity, but that's kind of where tech writers live. I say, if you know everything about your industry, then that's not really that fun. You're not learning anything. You want to go learn some, touch new things, break stuff. And sure enough, on my first day at Menlo Security, probably the biggest breach in the history of the internet happened. A little thing called the SolarWinds hack. Basically, 90% of the Fortune 500 were infected by this malware, Russian malware, attributed to Russian hacking groups back in March. And it wasn't even discovered until like December. So some of the biggest companies in the world are implicated. And on my first day, I was asked to help edit customer comms about the fact that we're aware of this, that we're taking care of it. We have not been impacted by this, but we have since updated our malware signatures and all the basic stuff to reassure our customers that we're on it and that you can expect that we'll communicate any changes. And that felt good. That when you start a new job, it's like, oh, you want to be productive.
You want to make an impact.
Absolutely. My second day, because the first day it came in at 5:30 p.m. I said, I'll check that in the morning, and not realizing that there was the CEO, the VP of product, there was all these really important people on this Google Doc trying to edit this to reassure people. I got a chance to show them what I could do within 48 hours of them hiring me. So I was blown away that I can have such an impact, because customers were responding with detailed, intricate questions. We had provided them some really, foundational links to read about the stuff. And so I really get to provide some value to customers and help people feel safer. And that's where I realized that I think I made the right decision, even though I love Atlassian. And maybe at one point down the road, there may still be a future for me in Atlassian. But I think I made the right choice and looking for some new responsibilities.
Yeah, I was kind of nodding here as I listened to your answer, because I just left a company that I loved and a team that I loved also, so to tackle a new challenge. So I totally get how you feel. It's sometimes it's hard to do these things, but when you know you're gonna do it. Yeah, I used to work with Ju, and I left Vitex to work for Nubank. So kind of in a similar position right now, but it feels amazing to change sometimes.
Oh yeah, I'm a big change agent. Like, I think it's important to feel like you can grow, but at the same time, so you know, one thing I would recommend anybody when they're leaving a job, and they're leaving on good terms, but still not the terms that you thought you'd be leaving on. Atlassian's got a huge culture internally of writing internal blog posts. Obviously, with Confluence having a blogging feature. It's used very, very often for everything from introduction blog posts to team announcements and promotion announcements, and exit and goodbye blog posts as well. And I can't pretend that I didn't shed some tears when I wrote my exit blog post for Atlassian, but I also didn't pull any punches. You know, I told them why I was leaving and what could have been done differently in my situation specifically. But that Atlassian had some work to do to make sure that other underrepresented people felt like they had a voice. That's me doing my duty as an Atlassian to give them the feedback I feel like they need to get better. And I've done that. I did that at every stage of my tenure at Atlassian, and I have no regrets. You know, I did some up until now the best work of my life, but I think only the best remains.
That's so great to hear, and that's a great company culture as well. It's good to feel heard and embraced even while you exit and join new opportunities. All right. So from now on, we're going to ask a few questions about your work at Atlassian, just because we've gotten in touch with Atlassian's documentation for being users of Atlassian products. So we're definitely curious to know about how you deal with tech writing over there, but feel free to mention Menlo and your current work as well in your responses. All right. So talking about Atlassian specifically, when and how did they decide to name the role content designer and not tech writer, for instance? Is it closer to design, product, or engineering, or support? How does it fit within the company?
Oh, what a fun problem that was to solve. So when I, in 2014, I went through like 9 months of negotiations and planning and visas before I actually set foot in Australia. From the time they made me the initial offer, and that whole time, they always said this role was for a senior technical writer, and but when I showed up the first day on my name tag, it had information experience writer, and they were calling themselves IXers, and right away that felt really goofy, but I could understand it. They when they explained it, the information experience is absolutely a thing, and it's very much a crucial. Part of building great software is to have a thoughtful information experience. That there's all kinds of conversations to be had around what an information experience is. But you can essentially think about it. It's just making sure that the messaging is consistent, for all the way from pre-sales to post-sales and end-of-lifing things. It's much more intricate and involved than that, obviously. But it made sense to me. And the first year, I think, maybe even year and a half, We were the IX department, and we were, I think, about 15 people when I first started, and Atlassian was had just eclipsed like the 1,100 people mark, and it was pre-IPO. This was also the first time, and this kind of, I want to say this went hand in hand when Atlassian started putting the writers in under the design umbrella, in the design organization. That was also around the time when technical writers started calling themselves information experience writers. So by the time I got there, I started and I was a fully fledged member of the design organization. They basically called us information experience writers, but it was known that we were at the same level as designers in terms of members of the product development team. And that was very exciting, because it was extremely different than every other company I'd worked up until then, which I've always been either tech writers can usually find themselves in a wide variety of departments, from engineering more traditionally to marketing to support. You know, I've reported to some managers who wanted nothing to do with documentation, but this was a department that was who the head of the department was a designer, and there was probably more designers than writers, but we were fully fledged members of the design organization. So much so that they flew us out. People who weren't in Sydney, they'd fly you out to Australia once a year for the design, the yearly internal design conference called Design Week, which was an absolute blast. Look, that's the first company I've ever heard of that flies writers anywhere. Writers usually, I didn't even ask whether there was a plane ticket. I lived in Sydney and I still assumed that maybe Design Week was not for me because I'm a writer. Like it's, writers get abused. We get abused. We put up with a lot. Like they don't.
Job alert.
Yeah. It's weird, but they treated us with respect, and they sought out our opinions, and we got to work on important stuff. And then all of a sudden, some of the design heads kind of went behind the covers and came back with this idea. Said we think that it might be better calling us content design. And it was, you know, Atlassian tries to be democratic about some of these things, and we did have a chance to weigh in on it. And when you just hold those two terms, information experience writer and content designer, up against each other, it's a pretty clear winner. Content designer just feels sexier. And it actually is probably more more indicative of what we do, especially at Atlassian. So half the job is traditional technical writing. You're publishing documentation in a wiki. And then the other half is really deep and intricate UX design research or planning or UI copy review at the design or project kickoff level. And that is what was probably the most fun about working at Atlassian. Because I don't know if I mentioned this already, but I was an Atlassian customer for a long time before I decided to apply for a job with Atlassian. Just like yourself, I was always impressed with Atlassian's documentation personally. Like, it helped me do my job. It made me look like a rock star. So now that I get to I got to play with the stuff and get beta versions, and it's like, oh, I was in hog heaven for a long time, and it was a great place to be. And content design kind of hit the nail. It hit the sweet spot. Like, I was actually a little annoyed when the conversation started that we're changing our title. I'm like, people are never going to know what we're called anymore. They're just going to call us the word people. Once I heard the pitch for why content design was a better choice than information experience writer, I was sold, and I've since adopted it is my official tagline or my official usernames now across the interwebs as Senior Content Design, because it speaks to the contribution I expect to have in a product team. It's not just the documentation. It's not just the UI. It is designing the information experience, and that always felt right to me. Because just doing the doc was never enough, and I've never been exclusively a UX writer, but I can't imagine that would be enough either. For the kind of things that I like to do with products and how I like to help users.
Something else we were wondering is who works on developer documentation at Atlassian. Mm. Did they have different types of tech writers for user and developer docs? Because in your presentation about tech writing tools, you mentioned four different terms, which are UX writer, API writer, mm-hmm. content mm-hmm. strategist, and information architect. So are all those different facets of the same role, or are they jobs performed by different team members?
That's a wonderful question, because it's a bit of a moving target. It didn't, when I first started, there were no exclusive writers for developer documentation, although there were a handful of longer tenured and more technical writers who would help out in a pinch. But it was very much the product teams, the engineers, and were responsible for getting a lot of that content out themselves. And it's still the case for a lot of the dev teams at Atlassian. But I think just 3 years ago, they started spinning up a brand new developer documentation team run by a good friend of mine. They're great. They get to work on the latest and greatest, the coolest things that Atlassian's working on. The writers on her team have got to have a finger in. But they're a very small team, and they're kind of like run like an agency, and that they're not dedicated to any one product. So they kind of go where the need is. Obviously, with Atlassian's product suite getting bigger and bigger every every year with every either acquisition or new product that gets invented, their workload is never going to get smaller. I could imagine it's only going to increase. And they do great work. I think I know all the writers on the team. I think the world of them. They're a world-class documentation team. You can look at the growing of their team size as an indication of the good work that they do. But that's pretty unique. For everything else with regards to writing and in regards to product writing, they're all embedded in specific product and feature teams. The need arises and a request will get written, and they'll try to fulfill it as best they can with whatever headcount they're allocated. It's a pull and tug like any other headcount and resource allocation.
Cool. Going into not your work specifically on Atlassian, but your opinion about this as a whole. So I feel that tech writing is also a job of letting go, because though we work really hard to make great documentation, especially on products that are available to the general public, not always will your documentation be featured first on a Google search, for instance. Yep. And the users themselves write documentation on Reddit, blog posts, and community forums. So letting go of your documentation is I feel that is also a part of our job, and to understand that the users might not be reading what you documented, but what the community has to say about the product. So how do you coordinate these community efforts? Do you feel that they're a positive addition to a product's understanding? How do you deal with this external influence over documentation?
That's a use case in the last two roles I've had in exploring the differences between the two. So with Menlo, obviously, cybersecurity company, we're much less public with our communications with our customers. They're usually behind a firewall or email directly to them, and that's a deliberate choice. Just because we don't need to expose ourselves, we won't. Although I think that we can probably eke it out a little bit more, but it's almost polar opposite of Atlassian, which is kind of open by default, and be the change you seek, and all of Atlassian's values kind of scream transparency. I'm a big believer in that talking directly to customers is always a good idea. In the community forum, people kind of let their guard down a bit, and they get to be candid and ask questions that they might not do in a service desk request. And then they also get to help each other out. And what was fun about the Atlassian community is that Atlassian tools, I've been quoted as describing them like a Swiss Army knife, and that you can use them in any way you want, including using them poorly. But that does mean that the user community pitches in and invents new ways to use Atlassian tools or ways to extend it. It never fails to impress me. That's just a great example of the kind of innovation and creativity that comes out of opening up dialogue with people who are using your stuff. And I can't see how that's a bad thing. I'm new to cybersecurity, and I'm sure that there'll be some notes to review about why we couldn't do that with our particular software. And that's okay, that's different worlds. But the long story short is that if you have the bandwidth to listen to customers, it's always a good idea. And the community kind of style, the discussion board style, is a great way to kind of get some organic traction around users doing unique things with the tools.
Cool. And also about a particular aspect of our tech writing job, which is how to deal with documentation for product launches and major product updates. So how do you plan for such product launches, and specifically about the new Jira Cloud experience, for instance? It changes a lot of things for users. Who takes part in that planning and execution process in your previous and current experiences? Do you have any interesting stories to share on that topic?
Oh, there's heaps. It depends on the scope on who will own it. When it's just a single screen or menu, or it's a smaller product with a smaller user base, then the designers and the PMs involved with the feature teams will plan out the change management, and usually involves an onboarding tour. With highlights the things that are different and has little dialogues that I'm sure if you've ever used Atlassian tools, you've seen these things, and they can get cumbersome at scale, but they The writing team has their hands all in those dialogues because they're usually just a very simple image and then usually two or three sentences worth of text. And Atlassians bang their heads against the wall making sure that stuff is right. And even when to you it may feel a little hokey or a little, maybe they're trying too hard, it's only because people care about this work and they want it to be good and useful and for users to see all the great work that they did. So change management is at the bigger scale, like something like what you're describing, the kind of new interface for Jira. Those things are months, sometimes years in the making. There's almost always a program manager involved who politely is herding the cats in across multiple product and feature teams to the same direction. But it all varies. I mean, there were some other instances, like when Jira became three Jiras. I mean, that was like 2 years in the making to split Jira into three different products. And of course, that took up a large amount of Atlassian's kind of energy and attention. But it was a fun challenge. I didn't understand it when they announced it or what I had to do as someone who worked on Bitbucket. But I think I'm 4 years out from that original forking of all the Jiras, and I get it. It seems like it works really well, and it was fun to be a part of that.
And what about documenting different versions of the same product or slightly different on-premises and cloud offerings like Jira Server and Jira Cloud? Do you see any interesting challenges for us tech writers there?
Oh, so many challenges. I hope that my former colleagues at Atlassian hear this blog post and they hear this particular segment or listen to this podcast and hear this particular segment. But at Atlassian, there's a very controversial mechanism that we use to publish different versions of the documentation. It's a little plugin for Confluence made by some vendors called K15T, and they're wonderful human beings. They make incredible software for Atlassian platform, but Atlassian's stuck on an older version of it. It's called Scroll Versions, and for all the server versions of the products, it's absolutely crucial because there's all, you know, you can imagine with Confluence, I think there are probably like 200, 300 versions now, with like 150 of them actively still supported. And each one of them could have some very minor differences that may require some differences in the documentation. And so to solve that problem, we use that plugin called Scroll Versions. And it essentially just allows you to create branches of a primary version of the documentation and then publish to different external spaces from one internal kind of primary space. And it sounds every bit as complicated and complex as it is. And I've been reassured that later versions of this plugin are amazing and that a lot of the kind of silly little gotchas that would trip you up on a daily basis in Atlassian are because we were dogfooding our own stuff and didn't get to the latest version to get the new Scroll Versions plugin. But it was painful, man, really painful, because it's just so many people working in this documentation and without always clear lines of governance about, there's some admin portions of Jira that are applicable to three different versions of Jira. So who's supposed to make this update? And so then you have to kind of coordinate. Jira might not be a great example because the Jira folks tend to have their stuff together. But you can see where I'm going with this, that the dependencies on shared work that don't have clear lines of ownership, or that the lines of ownership are blurred. And then, of course, you have this tool that tends to get in the way as much as it helps. Scroll Versions was, it's almost like a running gag at Atlassian that it was causing as many problems as it solved. Although when it originally was invented, or when it was originally rolled out to Atlassian, it was absolutely crucial. And Atlassian could not have done it, the content team could not have done what they've done without it. It's just that at the scale that we were using it and the kind of way that we were using it, it just was falling over and was painful. And I was just fortunate that I was a one-man team and on Bitbucket for a little while. I had a choice to adopt it, and I said, I think I'm just going to go with the vanilla Confluence and understand what I'm doing on a regular basis. But it's a hard challenge to solve. Atlassian deals with it, and every other company deals with it as well. If you find a company that's doing it elegantly, I say write a blog post about it, because everybody should see it, because it's hard, man.
So this was the first part of our interview with John Pass. Stay tuned, because very soon we will publish the second part of this interview, in which we will talk more specifically about diversity and inclusion in the tech writing business.
And by the way, we created a Goodreads bookshelf assembling all of our guests' book recommendations. So from Harry Potter to strategic writing for UX, our list will definitely inspire you. And the link for that and all links mentioned in today's episode are in our show notes. And we know we have a very specific scope on our show. It's not every day that you see independent Latin American podcasts about technology and writing that are written, produced, and edited by a team of only two people who happen to be Brazilian colleagues. So yeah, very specific. And your support is super important to fuel our project, and it's also completely free of charge. You can support us by subscribing to our show wherever you get your podcasts, by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts, and most importantly, by sharing it with a friend. See you next time.
Thanks for listening.